At noon on KSFR looks at the top local news headlines for this Monday, July 8th. Today sees a ribbon-cutting ceremony as Santa Fe County begins to provide water to the state penitentiary complex on Highway 14. For years, the facility, which includes the New Mexico Corrections Training Academy, has relied on the same well water system as residents of La Cienega and surrounding areas. All told, New Mexico Corrections Department has monthly water usage between 2.6 and 6 million gallons. It's expected that NMCD will pay some $200,000 annually for its use of county water. Civilian employees of the Department of Defense at various military installations here in New Mexico and around the nation begin their first day of mandatory furloughs today. They are forced to take one unpaid day off per week through September 18th. That amounts roughly to a 20% pay cut across 11 weeks, or 4% for the year. The cuts are part of the scattershot effects of the federal sequestration. Some 7,000 workers in New Mexico are subject to those cuts. The Bureau of Land Management has given its final approvals for 234 miles of new pipeline across New Mexico to transport liquid natural gas products. The Western Expansion Pipeline 3 project will follow an already existing pipeline corridor with six new segments to run parallel and be joined by valves. Work on the line, to span from Farmington to Hobbs, could begin before the end of summer and take 6 months to complete, says builder Enterprise Mid-American Pipeline. The estimated cost is $320 million. Tomorrow, the Drug Policy Alliance, veterans groups, elected officials, and others are introducing a campaign to protect New Mexico's military veterans' legal access to medical marijuana. They're hoping to eradicate employment discrimination against medically prescribed users and lessen stigmatization by some members of the state's medical community. In 2009, ours became the first medical marijuana state to specifically include post-traumatic stress disorder as a qualifying condition. Governor Susana Martinez came into office opposed to medical marijuana, and an attempt to deny PTSD sufferers access to cannabis was taken to the Department of Health in 2012, which they rebuffed in May. Barring redevelopment of severe fire weather, the nearby Heroso fire is expected to burn itself out over time without aid of a large ground crew. Recent rains have halted further growth beyond its 11,100 acres, and areas of burning have retreated from their outward edge. Meanwhile, our state's largest currently active blaze, the Silver Fire near Kingston in the Gila National Forest, is now at 80% containment. That lightning-sparked blaze began back on June 7th and has consumed almost 140,000 acres. Albuquerque's Route 66 corridor, considered the longest urban stretch remaining of that iconic highway, could soon become a bold swath of neon signs. That comes after city councilors there approved a number of proposals encouraging use of new and bigger neon signage. Today's Albuquerque Journal says it's intended to spruce up 15 miles of Central Avenue. Permit fees for the bigger, bolder signs are to be waived if they meet guidelines. Duke City Mayor Richard Berry, whose administration itself first proposed the idea, is expected to give his approval shortly. At tonight's meeting of the Public Works Committee, they'll consider recommending the creation of a gun safety promotional campaign for Santa Fe to be featured on city buses and benches. The measure met with approval from the Finance Committee last week and is scheduled for full City Council on Wednesday. It's championed by Mayor David Koss and City Councilor Patty Boucher, along with Police Chief Ray Rayel. On Wednesday, City Council could decide to create a new but small city park, to be named Cerletti Park, in honor of former Tourism Secretary Mike Cerletti, who died last year. It would comprise some 240 square feet adjacent to downtown's Water Street parking lot. That area has for some time attracted vagrants and has been the scene of harassment complaints. The creation of a park is seen as a move to improve public safety and beautification, with new landscaping and maintenance. Heading into the holiday weekend, the 65-year-old man who last year shot up one of Santa Fe's speed camera enforcement vehicles was sentenced to serve 18 months of unsupervised probation and pay for damages. Scott Powell was recorded by the vehicle's camera with gun in hand during the early morning hours of April 11, 2012. He pleaded no contest to numerous charges, including criminal damage and resisting arrest. Upon successful completion of probation, Powell, who no longer resides in New Mexico, will have his record expunged. Also over the long 4th of July weekend, former New Mexico Governor David F. Cargo passed away at age 84 while hospitalized in Albuquerque. He has the distinction of being the youngest person in state history to serve as governor. In 1966, the then 37-year-old Republican was elected to the first of his successive two-year terms. Cargo created New Mexico's Film Commission. And weather for Santa Fe. Mostly sunny days this week with high temperatures ranging from the mid to upper 80s. Each day brings a slight chance for isolated afternoon and evening thundershowers. Our recent rains have for the most part drifted from north to south, the reverse of typical monsoonal flow. However, meteorologist David Kraft with the National Weather Service office in Albuquerque says that the high pressure center responsible for that is due to migrate eastward over the next couple of days.
Now we're going to start to see the more typical moisture flow out of the south once that high pressure system gets east of New Mexico on about Thursday, and that'll last through at least Saturday. However, the models were indicating that the high might shift back over us later in the weekend into early next week, but we'll still have plenty of moisture in place to keep an active thunderstorm pattern going.
And at 13 minutes past the hour, the current Santa Fe temperature is 78 degrees. At noon on KSFR, we'll continue in just a moment.
Support comes from New Mexico Educators Federal Credit Union, where the more you participate in your not-for-profit financial cooperative, the more money you earn. For details on Earn Your Return, go to nmefcu.org or visit their branch on St. Michael's Drive.
And continuing now with today's feature stories at noon, they say all news is local. And that's especially true when local news is the topic. For the past 21 years, Santa Feans have been reading their local newspaper, the Santa Fe New Mexican, edited by the same man, Rob Dean, who is retiring. The paper has named a 17-year newsroom editor, Bruce Krasnow, as interim editor until a new permanent replacement is chosen. KSFR news reporter Joe Day sat down with the outgoing Rob Dean recently, and he files this report.
I'm Joe Day, and I'm outside the downtown office of the Santa Fe New Mexican, which proudly says that it's the oldest newspaper in the West, started 164 years ago. Doubtless there have been tremendous changes in Santa Fe in those years, and in the New Mexican too, of course. One of the newspaper's changes is happening now, as its editor, Rob Dean, is retiring after 21 years here. We talked the other day. Rob Dean, you've been doing this in this building for 21 years. Are you going to miss it?
Oh, I'm sure I'll miss it. But I did, some time ago, come to the decision that it was just time for me to shift gears and do something else.
And what is that something else?
Well, the honest answer is I don't know. I'm going to take a little bit of time to do some reading and relax and get this journalism thing out of my system. I've done it for 37 years. Almost every day for 37 years I've had a hand in putting out a daily newspaper. And I'm going to do something else. 22 years ago, I took a look at this wonderful, quirky, rich community, and a newspaper with the history of the New Mexican. It was founded in 1849, for heaven's sakes. And the fact that it was still locally owned. There are only, about 1,200 daily newspapers in this country, and probably no more than 120, 130 of them are locally owned.
And that figure is probably decreasing, too, as more papers consolidate and are bought up by the bigger chain.
Absolutely, yes, that is the case.
Why is that a negative thing in your view?
It doesn't mean that a corporate-owned paper or a corporate-owned news organization can't do its job well. There are many of them that do. But local ownership, I believe, increases the likelihood that it's going to live and breathe its stated mission to be part of a community and serve that community and throw open its arms and invite that community onto its pages and to express its opinions. The newspaper is a medium of delivery. It's definitely shrinking and changing, and we may not, what we see 10 years from now may not resemble very much what we saw 10 years ago. But journalism will live on. I think that we've been through this period of time where journalism itself and the nature of information and the appetite for information, the public's appetite for information is changing. But I think as I sit here today, I see no evidence that the public wants to know less about its world, less about how to navigate its life, less about how to make informed decisions in our democracy.
People of this area do have a number of choices. They've got the New Mexican. They've got the Santa Fe edition of the Albuquerque Journal. They've got radio, including our station. They've got television.
My view of that is, I'll bet you there's a lot of people in the world who think that is an environment for competition and rivalry. And I suppose there is some of that, and I think that's a healthy instinct in the news-gathering business to think you're competing with somebody to be first and best. But my view is not so much competition and rivalry. It's really a celebration that we want to expand the pie of readers. We want a big pool of active, engaged readers. And if that pool is large enough and engaged enough, then there's going to be a place for all of us to supply information that's important to them.
Why should people in the Santa Fe area care about the news of their community in the first place? I mean, people are busy. They've got a living to make. They've got children to raise.
If one is informed, one has the opportunity to celebrate what is good, identify what probably ought to change, and it is empowering about how to plug into the system to help with that change. The most obvious way is voting, but there's so many other ways to be active in this community.
We all know people who have said at one point or another, that blankety-blank New Mexican, why did they put that on the front page? Why do they stress this? They've got an agenda. And you hear that all the time, and you see it in the letters to the editor.
We criticize. We hold people accountable when we think they don't behave the way they ought to have or where the results weren't what the community needed. I think turnabout's fair play. I don't think there's any problem with somebody criticizing us. But I can say, I'm going to guess that the harshest critics of the Santa Fe New Mexican are the people who work at the Santa Fe New Mexican, who hope to do better tomorrow.
Every Friday, the New Mexican comes out with Pasatiempo, which, among other things, rates movies with a rating of 0 to 4 chilies. Honestly, how would you rate the New Mexican? How many chilies does the New Mexican get on a daily basis, do you think?
Okay, it gets 3 chilies by any measure. When you measure against peer news organizations that I know nationally, it rates 4 chilies. It isn't the New Mexican is exclusively valuable. The Albuquerque Journal, the Santa Fe Reporter, KSFR, and multitude of other channels are also important. But collectively, we're important. And we happen to be the largest of the news-gathering organizations in town. We're positioned as well as anybody to hold that position for a very long time.
For KSFR News at the Santa Fe New Mexican, this is Joe Day, Around and About Santa Fe.
21 minutes past the hour as At Noon continues. 150 years ago, the United States government forcibly moved a large number of Navajos and Apaches from their native lands and resettled them in the Bosque Redondo Reservation. Even though it was in southern New Mexico, Fort Union, located just north of Las Vegas, played a major role in the move. Lorenzo Vigil is with the National Park Service and joins us now to talk about the Long Walk. Mr. Vigil, what exactly was the Long Walk?
Well, the Navajo Long Walk involved essentially the removal and almost extermination of the Navajos. That was part of policy from the United States government. And it was essentially a failed four-year experiment of removing Native Americans from their traditional homelands and placing them in a camp, which at that point was called Bosque Redondo. Over 8,000 Navajos were moved down to Bosque Redondo between the years of 1864 and 1868. 400 Mescalero Apaches were also moved into that area.
Where was the Bosque Redondo Reservation, and from where were the Navajos moved?
Bosque Redondo is located about an hour south of Santa Rosa, New Mexico, near Fort Sumner, New Mexico, right along the Pecos River. It is Bosque Redondo in Spanish. Translating over to English is essentially round forest, and it's an area along the Pecos River with cottonwoods. Where did the American Indians come from? Well, of course, the Mescaleros Apaches came from southwestern New Mexico, north, and then the Navajos came, of course, from their traditional lands, homelands, which today is the same, which is northeastern Arizona, northwestern New Mexico.
And when were the Apaches moved there?
The Apaches had been moved already to Bosque Redondo before the Navajos ever showed up. Colonel Kit Carson had successfully negotiated their movement over from Arizona to Bosque Redondo. They had already been there at least six to eight months before the Navajos got there. They had already begun to build the fort. They began to cultivate the agricultural lands. They dug out a two-mile ditch or acequia for irrigation of these agricultural lands. So they had already been there way before the Navajos arrived.
Apaches and Navajos were not friendly to each other, were they?
Oh, no. In fact, you know, over the last 200 years, in terms of just with Spain ruling this part of the world back then, there were traditional enemies. Raiding was occurring between tribes in the region. You know, we had Utes and Navajos and Apaches, Comanches, you know, all raiding each other along with, of course, the Spanish/Mexican people in the area. And then later on in 1846, you know, the new Americans. So you had a series of raiding that was occurring amongst each other. And then later on, the U.S. Army again got involved with some of the raiding itself.
And why was this move made by the United States?
It's a twofold question there. One, it became a policy of the United States government to move them out of the traditional homelands to a new area to try to subjugate these peoples. And then the other half of it was there was a belief that there was great wealth, mineral wealth, to be found out in Navajo land. And that was one of the big movements. And they believed there was gold out there. A lot of these people in the United States government thought there was a way to utilize and use that mineral wealth.
Fort Union in northern New Mexico played a major role in the Long Walk, did it not?
Oh, yeah. In fact, I was really surprised when I was, you know, reading and doing research on Fort Union and their involvement with the Bosque Redondo project. Number one, the officers, the men, all the strategic planning for Bosque Redondo was undertaken by officers at Fort Union. They played a key role in the ongoing administration of it, the supply of the reservation throughout its four-year existence. All foodstuffs, clothing came through Fort Union. In essence, Fort Union was the lifeline for Fort Sumner and Bosque Redondo.
I know there are plans for a special program on July 13th honoring the Long Walk at Fort Union. Tell us about those.
All of our programming this year is focusing on that 150th anniversary of the Long Walk. We've already had a series of events that have occurred, but now in July, on July 13th, we have an opening of the first fort of Fort Union. And right alongside the first fort is the arsenal of Fort Union. And those were key areas in that area that were part of the Bosque Redondo, essentially, experiment, this internment camp. And what we're trying to do is show and talk a little bit more about the role that Fort Union played in the Long Walk. And we clearly understand that things have changed today, but at that point in those years, Fort Union was directly involved with the creation of Bosque Redondo. The officers, assisted in that creation, and we want to talk about these things. We have invited speakers already throughout the year, and our main focus is in that. So that first Fort Tours, we have a series of four programs dedicated to talking about the Long Walk and Fort Union's involvement in it, which is different focus for us, because what we're trying to do is begin to show the multiple perspectives of the different peoples that came through Fort Union, that were impacted by Fort Union, and subsequently injured, moved, removed, killed through what policies were at the government in the 1860s, and Fort Union's direct involvement with those.
And where can people get more information on the upcoming event?
They can visit us at www.nps.gov/FOUN. That takes them over to our website. And there's a link there that they can click on when they're at the website on things to do. There'll be a phone number there, which is 505-425-8025. Just hit extension 0, they'll get an operator, and they will be directed to the right person to set them up for the program.
Anything else you'd like to add?
Well, I just really think that people will really enjoy themselves, come on by the fort, learn more about the fort's very interesting history, and of course, coming out of the town.
Lorenzo Vigil with the National Park Service, many thanks for joining us here at noon on KSFR, which will continue in just a moment.
KSFR programming is underwritten in part by PNM, currently providing a recycling program for old refrigerators. PNM will pick up old refrigerators for free and then safely remove the coolant so it doesn't pollute the environment. They'll recycle as much of the refrigerator as possible. If you have a question for PNM, you can talk to them on Twitter or Facebook, or visit PNM online at pnm.com.
KSFR programming is underwritten in part by Greenfire Times, a new monthly publication focusing on all things green, including health, healing, organic foods, nutrition, permaculture, sustainability, green-collar jobs, and renewable energy. Greenfire Times is distributed at newsstands from Albuquerque to Taos. More information and an online edition can be found at greenfiretimes.com.
Jaguars have all but disappeared from our country. Now, thanks to new efforts, there's at least a chance for the species to survive here. Here's KSFR News reporter Charles Maynard with the story.
At one time, jaguars roamed in the Southwest, including New Mexico. Now the animal is all but extinct. Michael Robinson is a conservationist with the Center for Biological Diversity.
Well, we don't know of any jaguar in New Mexico today, although we do know that there is a jaguar currently living in Arizona. Jaguars were native to New Mexico. In fact, were native, as far as we can tell, to the entire southern tier of state, perhaps the southern half of the United States. There's historical reports from centuries ago of jaguars on the west coast and on the east coast, and certainly in New Mexico a lot more recently than that. But jaguars were eliminated with the course of development and persecution, loss of habitat, being killed both as a threat to livestock and simply for their beautiful pelt. So we have had jaguars in New Mexico, none known today, but that doesn't mean that they're not necessarily here. And more importantly, it doesn't mean that we couldn't recover them if we gave it an effort, as because they are an endangered species.
Estimating the number of jaguars in the wild in the United States is difficult to accomplish.
So the one is living southeast of Tucson in the Santa Rita Mountains and perhaps other mountain ranges as well, and he has been photographed repeatedly by motion-operated cameras. We don't have those kind of cameras in most places. For example, no cameras dedicated to capturing images of jaguars in the Gila, which is the best habitat, not just in New Mexico, but probably the best habitat remaining for possible jaguar occupancy in the United States. But without those kind of cameras, we're left with people's stories, and some of them may be true, and some of them may be mistaken identity for other animals. So an estimate would be just speculation on my part. I mean, one could say maybe there's another in addition to the one that's known. Maybe there's not. Maybe there's five others. They're very cryptic animals. And if you think about the fact that there are thousands of mountain lions in the western United States, but how seldom it is that somebody actually gets a glimpse of them, one realizes that if there's only 2, 3, 4, 5, 10 maybe, if we're very lucky, I doubt it's that many, jaguars in the United States, they're likely to be at least as well concealed as mountain lions are, and the chances of anyone seeing them are probably pretty remote.
The Center for Biological Diversity is pushing for a large protected area to be named for the imperiled animal.
The Center for Biological Diversity pushed to get jaguars protected under the Endangered Species Act, and in 1997 they were protected, and yet it was protection almost in name only because they did not receive a recovery plan or protected habitat for them. So we pushed again for those elements, and as a result of court victories, the jaguar is now the subject of recovery planning by scientists in the Fish and Wildlife Service and a proposal to designate critical habitat. So last year, there was a proposal for 838,000 acres, primarily in Arizona, but with some land in New Mexico, for jaguars. They did a reevaluation of their proposal before finalizing it and came out recently with a new proposal that adds almost 20,000 acres to what was proposed before, add some significant areas, unfortunately take some areas out. So just to talk about the good and the bad, one of the important elements that's been added is more protection for the sole jaguar that we do know exists in the United States, who is living in, at least in part, in the Santa Rita Mountains southeast of Tucson, and in an area that is targeted for a gargantuan open-pit copper mine that would dump toxic wastes over thousands of acres of national forest lands where this jaguar now roams. So the increase in habitat proposed, if it's finalized, would seemingly put a nail in the coffin of this ill-conceived mining project that would destroy habitat, not just for this jaguar, but for a whole host of other rare and imperiled animals and plants. The bad news is that there's still no proposal for habitat here in the Gila in New Mexico, where considerable numbers of jaguars could live if they were protected and if there was a recovery plan that encouraged their colonization of this area once again. But that area has been kept out apparently for political reasons. So we believe that it's an important area that should be added.
Michael Robinson with the Center for Biological Diversity.
The jaguar is native to the southern United States, and it's really our responsibility to restore this animal that, through our own thoughtless actions as a society, eliminated so many of the places where they roam, killed them off mercilessly, and now we have a better understanding that top-level carnivores are important to their entire ecosystems, and this is our opportunity to do right by an animal that we thoughtlessly eliminated from our shores.
For KSFR News, I'm Charles Maynard.
Every Saturday from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m., the Santa Fe Art Institute offers a free graffiti workshop for youth ages 6 to 19. Learn drawing and painting techniques from experienced graffiti teachers. All skill levels welcome. Learn about the history and influence of street artists from around the world. Work safely on free walls throughout the community and put your skills on display. To learn more, contact SFAI at 424-5050 for info.
12:34 here in the KSFR newsroom. Here at the bottom of the hour, it is our regular custom to spend 60 seconds with our resident curmudgeon, Christopher Hagen.
I never thought it would happen to me again. You reach a certain age, at least in my opinion, and the passions and desires that once occupied your thoughts and feelings tend to fade. I'm not talking about the physical stuff, but what's inside, the heart, the emotions. Hearing a song that reminds you of someone special, your cell phone rings and you answer without looking at caller ID, hoping that it's she or he. Going somewhere and always looking for them. When I worked in Manhattan, New York City, during my lunch I would walk to Central Park, bristling with anticipation because I knew I would run into the woman with whom I had fallen in love. I never did run into her, but the prospect made the walks vibrate with love buzz. I thought those days were gone forever, and then it happened out of nowhere, totally unexpected. Love. Beautiful, overwhelming love, so complete you could almost taste it. Well, actually, you could. Papado Shrimp Gumbo. For KSFR, I'm Christopher Hagen.
And with that, we conclude today's edition of At Noon. Dan Garrity with you here at the news desk. Many thanks today to my contributing colleagues, Joe Day and Charles Maynard. And we'll be back tomorrow with more news of and for New Mexico for you. And as always, we hope you join us.